You're listening to a DM podcast.
And I shine the torch and I'm looking for this snake. He's like, it's on my hand. There's a snake coming in and it's wrapped itself probably three or four times around his left arm. And I'm going, oh, wow. And it's still coming in and it's starting to constrict. And I'm like, where's its head? He's like, it's eating me.
Still breathing okay at the moment.
Is it a big property?
That blood pressure is not coming up.
Not a 493, understood, thank you.
Hi, my name is Lana Mitchell from the Royal Flying Doctor Service. This is a podcast about life in the bush, mateship, courage, and the role that the Royal Flying Doctor Service plays in serving rural and remote communities. This is the Flying Doctor Podcast.
My name is Kira Lee Dargan from the Royal Flying Doctor Service, and I'm an Aboriginal woman of the Wiradjuri Nation. This podcast has been recorded on Ngunnawal land and is being broadcast across all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nations. We at the Royal Flying Doctor Service want to acknowledge elders, past and present. The RFDS recognises that this is First Peoples land and always will be.
For those of us living along the highly populated eastern seaboard of Australia, we're so used to the change of seasons and the colder months of the year that it's hard to imagine living in a place where the climate allows you to live in a corrugated iron house with no windows or doors, and where the frogs and cockroaches and birds and snakes can come and go as they please. Wolverton Station is on Cape York Peninsula. In fact, it's past Cooktown and it's only about 6 hours away from the tip of the Cape, which is the most northern part of Australia. Emma Jackson was born and bred in England, a highly populated and cool, damp country. So living at Wolverton Station is a huge contrast. Wolverton is also a long way away from any hospital. So if things go wrong, Emma has to know what to do and how to manage things while help is on the way. Hello, Emma.
Hi, Lana.
So how did you end up in far north Queensland?
So I came to Australia about 22 years ago as a backpacker. Travelled around the country, and then I was in Cairns and I saw a small advert to go north. So long story short, ended up working in a roadhouse, the Arch River Roadhouse, that was owned by my husband. So Cheryl owned the Archer. Yeah, the Jackson family worked closely with Cheryl to build the Arch River Roadhouse, and yeah, met Neville, and the rest is history.
Ah, so Neville's long-term, many generations family living out there at Wolverton, is that right?
Yeah, so Neville's dad established Wolverton Station back in 1967 with another gentleman, and then had four children, and the two boys, so Neville and Kevin, then became partners, I guess, late teens, early 20s with their father. So Bill, Neville and Kevin are partners in the property. Bill is still going. He's 93, living in the Tablelands, and Kevin also lives on Wolverton Station. That's Neville's brother.
Right. Can you describe the landscape at Wolverton Station? How big is it and what does it look like?
Yeah, so Wolverton Station is, it's very central Cape York Peninsula. Really lucky. We don't have saltwater crocs. We're a little too far inland, and my husband raves that we haven't got any and he's never seen any. The landscape, we've got hills, we've got some mountains, we've got ridges, we've got valleys. It's green for 6-7 months of the year and then it goes brown for the remaining few months. It's about 300 square mile of country. We've got the beautiful Arch River running right through the middle of our property, which has, you know, lagoons and water coming off it. We've got lots of places to swim. We're a cattle station, so there's lots of dams and fencing, and we've got about 3,000 cows. So we have Brahman cattle that we breed, and we sell the males, keep the females to breed with the females. Our driveway is about 3 kilometres long. So the main peninsula developmental road is what runs up through Cape York. And yeah, our driveway is 3K. So 3K in and then you've got the homestead.
Wow. And could you describe your house and what it looks like and what size it is?
Yeah. So our home was built by Neville's dad. back in the 60s, and a few local fellas, and it's made out of stringy bark and corrugated iron. So John Williamson wrote a song about the house. He came here in 2002 and wrote a song called Granny's Little Gunya, and at that point Neville's mum and dad were here, so it was just before I came on the scene, and he loved the way it was built, the design of it. So there's no glass windows or louver windows. It's very open. Where the sink is, I can throw scraps to the dogs out the window there, because there's nothing in its place. The door isn't really a door. It's more of a little bit of corrugated iron. So it's very, very open. Do I like it? Yeah, it lets the breeze in. The way Bill designed it is just fantastic. It keeps it cooler during those months of October, November, December, when it can get up to 40 degrees. And obviously there's no aircon, so you're sticking with a fan circulating hot air. So, yeah, no, it's a wonderful little home.
Are there mosquitoes?
Yeah. Again, I was just saying to someone the other day, where Bill chose to build this home we've got Charlotte Creek not too far away from us, and the creek can flood, but it doesn't flood up towards the home, you know, the house. We're in a bit of a valley, so we get a really nice breeze. So you can drive to Weeper and it'll be 34 degrees by the time you get to Weeper, and here it'll be 24 degrees down in the valley, just in this little valley. I call it a valley. It's cooler. Yeah, we get a few mosquitoes, a few sandflies, but it's not extensive. Maybe one in your ear when you wake up in the morning, but it's not bad.
Okay. How far away is the closest city then? Would that be, or township? Would that be Weeper?
So Weeper is 2 hours, and Cairns is our major town. So I have two children in Cairns, one who goes to boarding school there and one who's just finished boarding school, and Cairns is about an 8-hour drive.
Right. So being so far from the city or from any sort of township, how do you deal with simple things like groceries and supplies and that sort of thing?
So we do grow some produce, and obviously we have chickens that lay eggs. We've got pigs. We occasionally get goats, and we have lots of cows. So we sort of do all right for our protein, and we can go catch fish. But yeah, we stock up through Weeper, stock up. We also have a mail plane. So every Tuesday we have Skytrans deliver our mail, and I can fax an order, email an order down on a Monday, and have fresh produce delivered round to Skytrans on the Tuesday morning. So it's packed that Tuesday morning and then brought to me by lunchtime. So for $20 plus the cost of the groceries, it's a bargain, absolute bargain.
Oh, wow. Wow, and we thought that Coles and Woolly online were pretty good. They don't come through the mail delivery system. That's great. So could you describe, Emma, what a regular day is like for you? Do you start with the clock or do you start with the sunrise?
And that's an interesting one, because every day is completely different. Every day is so different. So we have a dry season, a wet season. So I guess I'll start with seasons, only because then it's easier to picture, I guess, the content of the day. So our wet season usually kicks off around December, maybe some storms, October, November, but really work changes in December. The markets close, the road closes, you can't get your cattle to sale, you don't employ anybody. So December through to Easter, usually, you get rain, you have rain, lots of rain. And then through the dry season, which is usually just after Easter through to, yeah, October, you go hard. You start mustering your cattle, and the purpose of mustering is to get the younger cattle off, to spray them and vaccinate them, you know, check them out. So we bring all the cattle in, I guess, through May, June, send some to market to start bringing some money in, and do that, as well as, you know, you're repairing fences or building new fences, you're opening up the roads, grading the roads, doing your fire breaks. So that all kicks off. So a typical day in a wet season is very different to a dry season. I homeschool two children, so I have one in year 12, one in year 3. So my personal day is usually starting, yeah, when the sun wakes you up, doing a little bit of exercise and getting the kids motivated, and then doing whatever else has fallen on my lap. Yeah, work stuff, or I volunteer for a few different things and have a few other different roles. So usually something falls on my lap for that. And then husband comes home, so you help him with whatever he needs, or you drop everything and go help and get a few cows, or you go down the yard and then you go back to school and clean and cook and relax and go to bed.
Sounds idyllic, to be honest.
It is. And in the wet season, we do a lot of swimming. So either in the morning or the afternoon, we go for a swim. The wet season also, we go for picnics. We go down the Archer River and we watch the sunset over the beautiful river, have a glass of wine, you know, just eat some cheese and bickies and just enjoy the peace and quiet of the wet season of this time of year.
Now, that region is not always for the faint of heart, Emma. I mean, you're making it sound absolutely idyllic, but I understand in 2019 your property was subject to Cyclone Penny. I looked it up on Wikipedia, actually, and the cyclone path seems to go within spitting distance of your station. Is that right?
Yeah, and we had Cyclone Monica as well. That was nearly 17 years ago. So that was my first cyclone, I think, Cyclone Monica. So we've had, and Cyclone Trevor. So we've had a few cyclones come through while I've been here over the years. The one in 2019, I think we'd had a fair bit of rain. And the problem we have when we have a cyclone is, so we have rain, and then the ground gets so saturated that then the cyclone predominantly brings wind, which then just uproots the trees and vegetation. So everything just falls over because the ground's so wet. So, yeah, the damage to the fences. So you can imagine 20-30K of a fence line with a cyclone going over it. The trees just go dink. They literally just fall out of the ground. So,
right.
Yeah, some of the the rising creeks was quite huge from that one, and the wind. Again, coming back to the house that Bill built, doesn't move. It doesn't budge. It's completely cyclone resistant. I might not have any windows. A bit of rain comes in, but it doesn't shake.
And do you end up with a lot of disruption in the house with the wind and so forth coming in? And I don't know, because if I have a big storm here, I live on a property, a rural property, and I get some big storms that come over from time to time, and I can always safely button up my house and sort of say, okay, great, well, this can just pass and then I can open up again once it's gone. But you don't have that privilege or that capacity.
No, you just mop up the puddles and wash everything and dry everything and just you just suck it up and roll with it. You just hope go somewhere that you might not get wet.
I think there's a fair bit of, you know, the attitude that, you know, don't sweat the small stuff is what it sounds like from what you're talking about. It's not worth the stress.
It's really not. It's a bit of wind, a bit of rain, knocks things down. You can clean everything up if you get there.
Now, Wolverton is visited by so many people as they head to the northernmost tip of Australia. And you have quite a few lovely facilities and host a number of people and help them as they're travelling. Could you describe what those are?
Yeah. A couple of years ago, me and my daughter set up a glamping because we've got some spots on the station where we go, this is just glorious. We're so lucky. And then we thought, well, why don't we open this up a little bit to local people more than anything to come and really enjoy the just exclusive, having exclusive access to the beautiful water, the beautiful location, with no other tourists, no other people around. So we set up a glamping, Wild Wishes, which is just gorgeous. It's lovely. And we get a few people coming in, staying for the night. We get a lot of people, surprisingly a fair few people just popping in, wanting to see a cattle station on their trip north. We have a motorbike tour go through our property. We have two motorbike tours go through to avoid the Peninsula Developmental Road and all the main traffic. So they come through just north of the Archer River Roadhouse. And I think a fair bit of their trip, about, say, 30-40K of their main road trip is through our property, which just gives them a different experience. And a lot of them are from New South Wales, Victoria.
What do those people that are travelling through the region, what do they love about it the most?
I think it's mind-blowing for them. I think the terrain, the vegetation, like the hills, it can change. So we have friends come out and we do little adventures sometimes, and it's really great to show non-country folk what it's like out here. And you can go for a 10K ride and the vegetation can just keep changing. The type of grasses, plants, it all just changes. And I think if you're riding through the property or even walking through the property, you can just see the changes in wildlife, in birds, in vegetation, and it's quite exquisite.
Now, there's a lovely couple, Karen and Peter, who visit you regularly and are dear friends. Can you tell me a little bit about them?
Yeah, so Karen and Peter, Peter's Neville's second cousin. They've been friends for quite a long time and come up here. They used to come up a few times a year, and they've got, well, grown up, mature adult children. So they'd come up with their adult boys and go chasing a few pigs. Obviously, we've got wild pigs, wild dogs, and so they quite enjoy chasing wild pigs and just camping. They've got a business in Cairns, so they've all got businesses in Cairns. That just life gets busy. So they come up a few times a year. So, yeah, Karen and Peter came up actually just after Christmas 2021, the two of them, just to get out of Cairns, go off-grid, bring the little – they've got a little caravan – and Karen had a full-blown heart attack. So they were not even a kilometre away from my little humpy, and they had, yeah, she just collapsed at the motorbike.
So you were at home at the time, and I understand that you heard the motorbike at about 8 o'clock. Did you know immediately when you heard that motorbike at night time that something could be wrong?
Well, it was funny. It was December. Again, coming back to December season, you know, it'd been a bit rainy. It had rained that evening, so you sort of snuggled up in your nightie, having a glass of red wine. The children were playing cards with my husband, Neville. We'd heard them come back from an adventure around 5 or 6 o'clock. And where they were camping, like I say, it was less than a kilometre away, so you could hear their movements. And then we'd heard them go around 6:30, and we never heard them come back. And we were actually... when you're on the property, you can hear everything. You know what's going on. And we hadn't heard them come back. And then we heard this motorbike just after 8 o'clock, and it started to come and it started to speed up. And Neville and I were like, oh, something's happened. And he thought something must have happened to one of their dogs, because it's quite common when people come visiting and they have dogs and they chase pigs that a dog gets hurt. So they come in a bit quicker, and then he started beeping the horn. And that's when it was, oh no, this is serious. Something's happened. And he came onto my grass at the back of the house and pulled up right at the back door. And Karen was unconscious on the back of the motorbike, just lay on the back of the motorbike with her eyes open, just looking lifeless.
What did he say? What did he do?
Oh, I just grabbed the defibrillator. It was a no-brainer. As soon as he pulled up and you saw it, it was just think quick, get the defib. And he said, get the defib. Got the defib, opened it up, pulled his shirt up, put it on, and just started. And then said to Ryan to ring 000, said to Jess to get me scissors, you know, just threw the orders around, said to one child to take my 8-year-old into the lounge room. And, yeah, everyone just got into action, told Neville to get the torch. So just threw the orders around and everyone went to work. And the defib, it took 3 shots to get a faint heartbeat. And then I just started CPR. So Pete did the blowing into Karen's mouth side of it, and I did the compressions. But because it had rained and we were using the defib, I didn't want to put her on the ground, on the wet ground. So it was just carrying on the compressions on the back of the motorbike. And then once that heartbeat just felt a bit stronger, it was, okay, let's put a towel down on the floor and let's move Karen onto the floor and keep on going. So because it had rained, because it was December, the ambulance had a really slow, wet trip from Cowan. So I think the ambulance took a good hour. So, yeah, CPR, I think we did it for probably about an hour and a half all up. Karen, it was interesting watching Karen be completely lifeless, eyes open, unconscious, to you could feel the circulation increasing, you could feel the organs almost coming back to life, you could feel Karen's body responding, and it was quite incredible. Really incredible. Like, not once did her face lose circulation, so it kept poking in the face, but she'd start to squirm or she'd move a hand, or then she'd groan, and then it was just reassuring her that, you know, this is only temporary, because the 3 shocks would have really been creating a bit of pain. So, yeah, just carried on.
I have to ask, had you already been trained in how to do CPR and use a defibrillator? Like, is this the first time that you've actually had to do this or on a real person?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was scary as hell. Even when I picked up the defib, I thought, oh, God, please work. Please just, you know, you hope that I've got the skill and the knowledge to, you know, make this happen and hopefully it all just, yeah, works.
Wow.
The defibrillators were given to us through RFDS, and RFDS came up with the defib and provided some training. So it was fantastic. So they came up, they provided the training and have supported us with the defib. RFDS also give us a medical chest where we have all the essential medications that we could need in an emergency or everyday use. So RFDS are always on the end of the phone. And yeah, the training with the defib was obviously really good because it worked. Had we not had the defib, Karen wouldn't be here. It's that simple. They, when she was flown out, they said at ICU she had no chance of survival. They brought all the family in to say their farewells because they classed it as a widowmaker's heart attack. And they say with a widowmaker heart attack, you've got 12% chance of survival. And that's if you're in town and the ambulance gets to you rapidly. So the fact that Karen was here with all the elements against her, with, you know, basic CPR and a back garden on a motorbike and a defib and the rain, and then Neville had to drive the ambulance. It was that touch and go with Karen. The ambulance officer and the nurse continued to work on Karen in the back of the ambulance while Neville drove the ambulance to Cohen to meet the RFDS plane.
Wow. So how were your kids and Neville and Peter, how were they coping with this? Because it definitely sounds like you went into sergeant mode and you were making sure everybody knew what they needed to do, where they needed to be. Did they respond well to this real crisis that was happening right there, you know, outside your home?
Yeah, and that was also what was incredible is, you know, I take my hat off to all of them for their leadership. But none of them ever questioned me. None of them ever questioned, does mum know what she's doing? Are you doing the right thing? None of them. Even Peter was so good. He basically did everything I asked. All of them did. And we worked really well together as a team because obviously Pete was so vulnerable and it would have been scary as heck for him. It was just awful. But none of them questioned them or me. And it was really beautiful, Lana. We just worked well as a team. Everyone stepped up and everyone went into drive mode. Yeah, it was good.
So Neville drove the ambulance with the staff in the back keeping Karen Ara alive, and then they got her to meet the RFDS. Did you get to hear from Neville? So I presume you didn't go. You stayed at the station,
of course,
is that right?
No, of course I went. I wasn't going to stay at the station. I was not staying here, no way. So what happened was Karen was, through the CPR process, she was coming back to life. She was really coming back to life. So then she was fighting me. She vomited. She was fighting, and she was putting up one hell of a fight. Like, it was really just groaning, but her hands and fists were fighting. Now, I was really worried about brain damage. That was my only concern. I didn't in any way, shape or form think she was going to die. I was just worried about that the oxygen starvation and how long it had been between her collapsing and then coming to me. But yeah, ambulance came, and because she was fighting, that was their struggle, was to care for her in the ambulance while she was groaning and fighting. It was, and also the ambulance guys were talking to, the ambulance and the nurse, sorry, were talking to RFDS. So RFDS were being fantastic. Now, what we did find out was that there was a plane up at Bamaga. So there was a lady up at Bamaga who'd been waiting to be flown south. But because of the weather, again, it all comes down to the weather, she'd been up there for a while. And RFDS weren't able to get up there sooner. So this one evening, RFDS were able to go to Bamaga and fly the lady south. However, it changed and the plane came down to Cohen to pick up Karen. So Neville drove the ambulance and myself and Pete followed the ambulance. And when we got to Cohen, the plane was just coming in and the doctor and nurse set up a fantastic setup on the airstrip and basically basically put Karen in a coma on the airstrip. So we all worked together. Every one of us chipped in and helped in some way, whether it was removing Karen's jewellery or doing this or helping past this. So we all worked as a team under the thousands and thousands of flying ants, because again, that time of year when you've got your first bit of rain, all the flying ants and the insects come out. And off they went and flew her to Cairns.
Were you kept updated by Peter on her condition, and when was the next time that you learnt of how she was progressing?
Yeah, so I obviously left the children here. I mean, Ryan was 17, so the children are, you know, three of them are teenagers. And got back here about 2-3 in the morning. And then Peter rang me at, must have been about 6 or 7, and said, oh, yeah, no, they don't think she's going to survive. I said, nah, that's not true. She will. I said, in no way, shape or form does she die. She did not die. I said, and I'm not accepting that she won't survive. I said, nah, Pete, hold out hope, mate, because she will survive. It's just whether or not there's that. It's what damage has been done from the ordeal. So they brought everyone in to say goodbye, and they were adamant that she wouldn't make it. I think it was Saturday, and I was so sore. I was so sore and tired and just emotionally, mentally, physically drained. I was exhausted and also quite emotional. That next day was just a bit of a whack. And then later that night, or the next morning, I think it was, they were like, yeah, no, her organs are doing all right. She's looking all right. And they took her for a CT scan, and they were like, oh, she's doing okay. And then she came out of intensive care and she was talking. So I was like, righto, I'm going. So because she had all the personal stuff here, and it was, you know, as a female waking up after that ordeal without your knickknacks, it's like, nah, I'm going down. I'm taking Karen her essential stuff, and I'm going to see her. I want to see her for myself. And so I drove down. And then when I got to Mareeba, rang Peter and he said, oh, do you want to say hello to her? And I was like, what? She can talk? In 48 hours, she was conscious. So it was quite incredible. Her recovery was remarkable. And it's not been an easy road for Karen, and it still isn't an easy road for Karen. She's still recovering. And I think the stress and the trauma will, I don't know, I can't talk on behalf of Karen, but I question whether Karen and Pete would ever recover from that. It was just such an ordeal for them both. Yeah, it's heavy.
But gosh, she's a fighter though, isn't she? Holy moly. I mean, that's...
She really is a fighter. And we've met a lot of the doctors and nurses and ICU staff over the last sort of year who've either been through here, been here, or seen Karen, or attending Conquer the Corrugations walk that we organise. And they've all said what an absolute true fighter she is. And she fought. She wasn't dying, and she fought. And so did Peter. They both fought together.
What did you say, Emma, when you saw her and you got to go and talk to her that day?
Oh, it was incredible. It was really remarkable and so good. It was just so good to give her a cuddle and give her some love and I guess help her and reassure her that it's all okay, because she had no memory. Poor Karen was, I think she also had a few cracked ribs from the CPR and she was just sore. She was sore. She was, recovering. But it was beautiful. It just shows you, I think, though, if you've got a little bit of training, you've got some tools, doesn't matter where you are, if you've got like RFDS and ambulance and the tools and the training, you can really save someone's life.
Well, it really is so true, because you're in such a remote part of Australia that to be able to pull off this amazing miracle with Karen and have her still alive today shows how that little bit of training and the use of a defibrillator can just change the course of life. It's quite remarkable.
Thank you. And yes, has it changed my attitude? Probably. I've always believed that, you know, with a bit of fight and a bit of perseverance, you can achieve anything. But Karen fought so hard that night, and we all did our bit. But without Karen's fight and sheer determination, it's really Karen who's the hero. Karen fought to be here.
Yeah. Now, I understand that that's not the only emergency you've had to respond to. Could you tell me about your son, Ryan, being bitten repeatedly by a 3-metre scrub python?
Yeah, so I think that was about 4 or 5 years ago. I think he was 13, 14. And this is, I do laugh at this story. Like, this, the story about Karen isn't funny. It's a wonderful, beautiful story of tragedy and a brilliant outcome from tragedy. The story of Ryan, I chuckle because I was asleep and all I could hear was Ryan going, "Mom, Mom, Mom." And I thought, oh, what's going on? So I get my little torch and, well, what's up? And he's like, "Snake." And I think, oh, yeah, we're all okay with snakes. You can lie in bed and a snake will go across your beam above your head. And you go, oh, yeah, it's a python. He was laying in bed and I went in. And he's like, "There's a snake. It's eating me." And I'm like, "Eating you? Don't be ridiculous." And I shine the torch and I'm looking for this snake. He's like, "It's on my hand." And he's lay there on his back with his left arm up against the wall. So just sort of up, and there's the window, obviously with no glass or louvers. So this sort of rectangular gap in the wall, there's a snake coming in, and it's wrapped itself probably 3 or 4 times around his left arm. And I'm going, oh, wow. And it's still coming in and it's starting to constrict. And I'm like, "Where's its head?" He's like, "It's eating me." And then I shine the torch on the top of Ryan's hand, and here's this scrub python head sort of over the top of Ryan's hand, just opening up its jaw to move down Ryan's hand, to take Ryan's hand into its body.
That's horrible.
But it was really incredible. I mean, it's horrible, but I was like, wow. And then I shouted Neville, and Neville came, and we're going, "What do you do?" Because you try to take the snake off Ryan's arm, and the more we tried to, I guess, pull the snake off, the more it would move down Ryan's arm. And then the more we battled with its mouth, the more it would constrict Ryan's arm. And we're going, oh, my God, and it's still coming in. And with a snake, the teeth angle backwards, so you can't just lift it up because the teeth, and they've got hundreds of teeth, and the teeth, yeah, they angle backwards. So it was like, what do we do? Because we couldn't kill the snake. It was just like, oh. So there was a Commonwealth Bank platypus money box. So all my kids have got accounts at Commonwealth Bank. And when they opened an account, they got a platypus money box. So sitting next to Ryan's bed was this money box. And the shape of the platypus beak was perfect to just sort of wedge. So I grabbed the platypus and said to Neville Ratto, you lift the bottom of the jaw and I'll wedge this in the top of the jaw and we'll pull the snake's head sort of forward and hook it out. So yeah, wedged it in under the top of the snake's, yeah, the top part of the snake's mouth, while Nev sort of angled down the bottom of the jaw, and we got the mouth off and then, yeah, took it off Ryan. Then Nev took the snake and then I took Ryan straight to the sink, cleaned all the wounds on his hand, and then we actually strapped him, because although we were sure it was a scrub python, you know, we thought better to be safe than sorry. We better do a proper snake, a snake bite bandage. We rang RFDS, who also agreed that, yep, snake bite bandage is the way to go, just in case we're wrong and it's not a scrub python. But also RFDS were keen to fly Ryan out, just to be on the safe side, and also make sure that there were no teeth in there, no toxins, no poisons. Yeah. So because Ryan was okay, he was a little bit traumatized, we went up to Weeper, and then, yeah, thanks to RFDS, he got flown down to Cairns and, you know, got tested and checked over, and, yeah, was then free to go.
I reckon Ryan's got to be one of the few kids on this planet that can say, "I was eaten by a snake."
Oh, I know. It's lucky he's such a chilled out. He's such a chilled out lad. Like, he's such a good lad that it could have traumatized him for life, just going to bed worrying about a snake. So we did actually put some chicken mash up on that window after this. So no snake coming. What was funny was 2 years ago, it was about a year later, he came back from boarding school for the holidays, and he got into bed and there was another scrub python in his bedroom, and he's like, "Mom." And I'm like, "Oh, you're kidding." It was just funny. It's like, what are the chances? And like my husband says, never in, you know, 50 odd years has a snake ever come in to try to eat any of them. However, I did have a, I think Trixie Belle was about two or three at this time. I was grateful that the snake chose Ryan over Trixie, because Trixie was such a dainty little girl that if the snake had gone for Trixie, it could have killed her. Like,
yeah,
it could have done some really damage. So it's a little funny, but it's also really serious that this actually happens up here, and it's really scary.
Well, you know, when I think about the perspective of somebody that lives overseas and all they ever hear about Australia is our deadly snakes and our deadly spiders and our deadly jellyfish and our deadly crocodiles, and then you hear a story like this, and, I mean, that even blows my mind. You know, I can't conceive of a snake coming into me while I'm sleeping and starting to eat me. So that's a whole new level, Emma. It's a whole new level.
The other day, Trixie Bell, my year three, she can't wait to go to boarding school, and she's really excited. And she started Googling boarding school, and like I say, she's only eight, and she was so chuffed because she started Googling boarding school, and under the images, there was an image of Ryan because the title was Boarding School Student Gets Attacked by a Snake. So there's Ryan with full of snake bites. It went international. It even hit like Europe, UK, Ireland. Like it was all over the media. It was shocking.
Yeah, because it's such an amazing, unique and strange, baffling story that you just couldn't make it up. I think if somebody tried to make up a movie on it, they would say, oh, it's unreasonable. It would never happen. But here it is. It has happened.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and there was a lot of that because obviously it went crazy, and there were a lot of social media comments going, no, that's not true, that didn't happen. Well, it kind of did. I've got to be really honest, Lana, when it did and I looked at it, I was like, this would make such a good photo. Like, to capture the snake's head over the top of the hand whilst it's constricting, whilst it's still coming in, was absolutely mind-blowing. I obviously didn't take a photo because it was just cruel, but it was mind-blowing. It's something I've never, ever seen before.
Wow. Now, Emma, you founded an initiative that aims to raise awareness for mental health and suicide prevention. Could you tell me about that initiative?
Yeah, so I think it was 9 years ago, my nephew, so Kevin is my husband's brother, so Kevin's son Dylan, fourth child, took his life. So I think he was 20, and yeah, he took his life, which was really, really, really sad, and devastating for the whole of the Jackson family, and Dylan's friends and friends of Debbie and Kevin. You know, it just shook that broader community. And then a few of us came together and we came up with this initiative called Conquer the Corrugations, which is a walk for mental health awareness. It was a walk, 42K over 2 days. It was a lot of work, a lot of hassle, and well worth it. And it was really just to raise awareness of mental health, to honour loved ones lost, support those affected, come together as one, and talk about it and try to remove the stigma around mental health, help suicide prevention. And it's evolved into an event that is really tight, close-knit group of people who organise it. There are a few of us who work really well together. So there's a couple of us who work behind the scenes sort of all year doing stuff that needs to be done. And then there's people who are more at the front facing who help out over the weekend and planning and organizing, like leading up to it. So there's different people who have different roles. Does it work? Yes, it works. I think Conquer the Corrugation is saving lives. It's helping people understand why talking is so important, and that we all go through different times of ups and downs. And that's exactly what we've tried to do with Conquer the Corrugation, is create an event that's tough, that mirrors your challenges and your good times in life, that you've got good times, but you've also got harder times, and that is life. Mm. And it's about perseverance. It's about support. It's about openness. And it's about talking. RFDS have been a supporter since day one. And now we have clinicians who come along on the walk and walk with the walkers, do like help your mate yarn and different sort of provide different tools and strategies for people. Which is just fantastic. And I think the connections that the RFDS workers have created through Conquer the Corrugations are just invaluable for RFDS, but also more invaluable for the people and the broader community of Cape York Peninsula.
How many people are involved in the event on an annual basis at this point?
I guess it averages 200, and there's probably maybe a quarter to a third who who generally come back. But what we find is people don't do the walk every single year, not generally. What they might do, they'll do it 1 year, not do it for a year or two, then do it again. Okay. So we're seeing a bit of a pattern. We're also seeing, like last year, 2022, we had a group of Victorians come. They'd lost somebody. And we find that Conquer the Corrugation is a really safe, inclusive place. So if you've lost someone or you've thought about ending your own life, it's one of those places that you can come and you won't, you know, you can just be you. So we had Victorians come because they'd suffered a loss. And they took a lot away. The whole event is free. You don't pay for any of it. Your camping is free. Nearly all your food provided for the whole weekend is free. And we have prizes and awards that again, come at no cost. So we're fully able to do that because of organization and businesses supporting us and because of volunteers, which is fantastic. So the Victorians went away and they actually rang me about 2 months ago saying, hey, we want to pull a Conquer the Corrugations together in Victoria. So it's like, okay, let's do it. So they're very much leading the Conquer the Corrugations in Victoria, and it'll take place at the end of May, 27th, 28th of May, down at Winchelsea.
Wow.
Out from Geelong. And so Shelley and I are supporting them with the backroom stuff. So we've created a page on our website. We're helping them with registrations and some media. We're just doing some of the, I guess, the stuff that we do for Conquer. Our Conquer. Yeah. And what we've done is we've modified the logo. So we've taken Cape York off the Conquer the Corrugations logo and off the website. So, or reduced it on the website so that if anyone wants to do a Conquer the Corrugations, as long as the essence and integrity of the event mirrors the essence and integrity of Conquer the Corrugations, then let's do it. Let's try to roll Conquer the Corrugations out more across the whole nation.
Oh, that's such an amazing initiative. If somebody wants to get involved or wants to get more information, what should they do?
We have a Facebook page and a website, so conquerthecorrugations.com.au, which is updated, and it's got the information for this year's walk, which is the 30th of September, 1st of October. Shelley and I, so Shelley Radloff and myself, we monitor the emails, monitor the Facebook page. So we're quite active on those. But, yeah, so there's information online that's easy to find.
Such amazing work that you do, Emma. When you left England, did you ever imagine that this would be your life today?
Nope. No, but I love it. I love that I think we live in a fantastic country. I've traveled a lot of this world, of this planet, and I think Australia is certainly one of the best places to live. The freedom and the opportunity we have in this country is not like anywhere else I've ever been or experienced. I went back to England earlier this year, and it was such a shock going back to that country and just how different it is, how diverse it is to this place. It's just such an opposite.
Do you have any advice for people who are traveling around or in Australia, visiting remote locations such as Wolverton?
Yeah, make sure you go bush. You know, I think we can all see the more commercial places, see the cities and the towns, but go remote, go out back, go bush, go off the grid, and don't be afraid to just pop into a place and say g'day. Don't be afraid of dangers, because dangers probably won't kill you. You know, just, yeah, go and see, go and explore, and just get off the grid.
Yeah, and be prepared. Take a defibrillator with you.
you know, honestly, Lana, don't joke. I honestly suggest if you're that bit older or in any way, shape or form worried about your health, then it doesn't cost much for a defib. I reckon in another 10 years, I'd always have one in the car, like a satellite phone. Would you go off the grid without a satellite phone or without access to communications? Probably not.
Yeah.
So take a defib, take a first aid kit, and make sure. I'm a big fan of first aid training, though. If you don't know what to do in an emergency, you're stuffed. Get some basic training. Even if you've got to watch some videos, do a course, get some basic training. You do need to know what to do with a snake. You do need to understand your snakes. You do need to be conscious and cautious around water holes and out bush. But with a bit of basic training, a bit of common sense, and a sat phone, a defib, you'll be right.
I would love to learn more about the work that you do with Aboriginal children. Would you be able to tell me about that?
Yeah. So So I've got a psychology degree, qualified teacher, health and fitness instructor, and did my equine assisted learning practitioner course to bring it all together so I could work more with local people. So in 2021, delivered a program that Rio Tinto funded. So I worked with every teenage girl in Napranum, and they came out here each for 3 days, and it was using a horse as a co-facilitator to help the girls understand sort of who they are, understand boundaries, build their self-awareness, understand the difference between discomfort and fear, and just really build them up and give them an opportunity to get to know their strengths and how amazing they were. I've been doing some work with PCYC as well, a similar program using equine assisted learning, and also doing a program with RFDS, a holistic social emotional well-being program for adults. So that's really exciting.
That's fabulous. I'm coming to visit you. I am so coming to visit you. I did an interview about a month ago and I decided I'm going to Andamooka in remote South Australia. I have so decided I'm going to Andamooka, and now I'm coming to Wolverton Station. You won't be able to keep me away.
It is magic. It really is.
You're an inspirational woman, Emma. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you so much, Lana. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. Word of mouth is always the best promotion for a podcast. So if you enjoy this podcast or a specific story, please share with family and friends. If you haven't already, join our Facebook group called the Flying Doctor Podcast Community. And you can also send feedback, questions or comments to me directly at lana.mitchell@rfds.org.au. Donations to support the Royal Flying Doctor Service can always be made through our website at flyingdoctor.org.au. The Flying Doctor Podcast was presented by me, Lana Mitchell, and senior producer is Mandy Coolin.